A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about something most people never think about when they board a plane. The aircraft you're sitting in. The one with the airline's logo painted on the tail. The one with their livery and their crew uniforms and their branded safety card in the seat back pocket. There's a better than even chance that airline doesn't own it. Not even a little bit. It belongs to a leasing company you've probably never heard of.
Over half the global commercial fleet is leased, 50-55% depending on which quarter you're measuring. And for some airlines, it's basically 100%. They don't own a single aircraft, they just rent them.
Which is wild when you think about it. These are $100 million assets, flying around the world with a company's name on the side. And the company is essentially a long-term renter with really good branding.
Daniel's question gets at exactly why this is so interesting. Because it's not just one kind of lease, and the decision to lease versus buy isn't random. There's a whole financial and operational logic to it. Dry leases, wet leases, the economics behind the choice, and a really sharp divergence between how passenger airlines think about this versus cargo operators. FedEx and UPS own most of their planes. Your average low-cost carrier in Southeast Asia owns almost none.
That's what we're unpacking. Two fundamentally different types of leases, the math behind the buy versus rent decision, and why the cargo guys look at this problem and come to a completely different answer.
Let's put some names and numbers to this thing. Aircraft leasing is a $300 billion plus industry, and it's dominated by companies most people have never heard of. AerCap, they're the biggest, over 1,500 aircraft in their portfolio. Air Lease Corporation, SMBC Aviation Capital, these are the giants. They buy planes in bulk from Boeing and Airbus, get massive discounts, then rent them out to airlines for 5 to 12 years at a stretch.
The airline just operates the plane, puts their logo on it, flies their routes, collects the ticket revenue, pays the monthly lease bill.
And this is where the two flavors come in. A dry lease is just the aircraft. No crew, no maintenance, no insurance. The airline takes the keys and handles everything else. That's the standard arrangement. Probably every plane you've ever flown on was a dry lease or owned outright.
A wet lease is the opposite. You get the plane, the pilots, the cabin crew, the maintenance, and the insurance. The industry calls it ACMI. Aircraft, crew, maintenance, insurance. It's basically renting an entire operational airline within an airline for a few months.
Wet leases are short, 3 to 24 months typically. If British Airways needs extra capacity for the summer rush, or an airline's own planes are grounded for maintenance, they'll wet lease from someone like Norse Atlantic or Titan Airways. The plane shows up with a full crew, flies the routes, and disappears when the contract ends.
Dry lease is renting an apartment unfurnished. Wet lease is a fully serviced hotel.
And it raises the question Daniel's really getting at. If you're an airline, why pay rent forever on a $100 million asset? Why not just buy the thing?
Especially when you look at the trend line. Back in the 90s, about a quarter of the global fleet was leased. Now we're at over half. That's a massive structural shift in how the industry finances itself.
The answer isn't just airlines can't afford to buy, it's more interesting than that. It's about balance sheets, flexibility, and who's better at betting on what a used plane will be worth in a decade. But that's where the mechanics really start to matter. Let's walk through the dry lease first, because that's where the real financial engineering lives. A typical dry lease runs 5 to 12 years. The lessor, AerCap, say, buys the aircraft, takes delivery from Boeing or Airbus, and immediately leases it to an airline. The airline gets a bare aircraft. They supply the pilots, the cabin crew, the maintenance program, the insurance, the fuel, the landing fees, every operational cost. The lessor just collects a monthly payment and retains ownership.
The airline never builds equity. At the end of 12 years, they hand the keys back and walk away with nothing.
Right, and that sounds like a terrible deal until you look at what they're buying. A new A32neo lists for something north of $110 million. Even with manufacturer discounts, an airline might need to put down $15 to $20 million in cash per aircraft. If you're a startup trying to launch with 10 planes, that's $150 to $200 million just in down payments, before you've sold a single ticket.
Whereas with a dry lease, you're paying monthly out of operating revenue. It's an operating expense, not a capital expenditure.
This is where the accounting gets interesting and where something big changed in 2019. Before that, under the old rules, operating leases were completely off the balance sheet. Airlines could carry enormous lease obligations, and they'd only show up in the footnotes. IFRS 16 and ASC 842 changed that. Now those lease liabilities have to go on the balance sheet as a right-of-use asset and a corresponding debt.
One of the classic accounting advantages of leasing basically vanished overnight.
It's still treated differently than a purchase loan. The debt classification is different. The depreciation treatment is different. But yes, the hide the liability trick is mostly gone. What's left is the capital preservation argument. If you lease, you keep your cash and your credit lines free for operations, fuel hedging, payroll, route development. An airline that owns 100 planes outright has billions tied up in metal. An airline that leases them has that same fleet, but the capital is liquid.
Which brings us to the lesser side of the table. How does AerCap make money if they're just the middleman?
AerCap orders aircraft in batches of 50, 100, 200 at a time. Boeing and Airbus give them pricing that no individual airline can match, except maybe the mega carriers like Emirates or Ryanair. So the lessor buys at a deep discount, leases it out at a rate that covers their financing costs plus a spread, and then at the end of the lease they still own an aircraft with residual value.
That residual value bet is where they either make a fortune or lose their shirt.
That's the whole game. A lessor has to predict what a 12-year-old A320 will be worth in 2038. If they guess right, they can sell it into the secondary market or re-lease it at a profit. If they guess wrong, if a new engine technology makes the old model obsolete, or if a global recession tanks aircraft values, they're holding a depreciating asset with no lease income.
Which is exactly what happened during COVID. Lessors had hundreds of planes returned early, parked in the desert, and suddenly the residual value models went out the window.
We'll get to that. But the secondary market is the other piece Daniel asked about, and it connects directly to this. Airlines don't just buy new from the manufacturers. A huge portion of the global fleet changes hands to lessors and brokers after the first lease ends. A plane might spend its first 8 years with a European flag carrier, then get refurbished and leased to an African or Southeast Asian startup, then get sold to a cargo converter.
IndiGo is the classic example. They launched in 2006 with leased A320s, didn't own a single plane. As they scaled past 100 aircraft, they started buying directly from Airbus. But the leasing phase was essential for getting off the ground.
That's the pattern. Lease when you're small and capital constrained. Transition to ownership once you have the balance sheet and the route certainty to make long-term asset commitments worthwhile. The research suggests that threshold is somewhere around 50 to 100 aircraft before direct manufacturer purchases make economic sense. Below that, you're almost always better off leasing or buying secondhand.
The wet lease is a completely different animal. Shorter term, more expensive on a per month basis, but you're buying operational simplicity.
Capacity on demand. Norse Atlantic is a perfect example. They fly transatlantic routes, heavy demand in northern summer, much lighter in winter. So during the winter months, they wet lease their 787s to other carriers. The aircraft, the Norse crew, the Norse maintenance program, everything, just operating under someone else's flight number for a season. Norse keeps their aircraft utilized and generating revenue instead of sitting on the ground.
It's also how airlines handle disruptions. If an engine recall grounds half your fleet, you don't go buy replacement planes. You wet lease for 6 months while the engines get fixed.
It's how carriers enter new markets without committing. Want to test a route from London to some city you've never served? Wet lease, an aircraft with a crew that already knows how to fly it. If the route works, you transition to your own metal. If it doesn't, you let the contract expire and walk away. No stranded asset, no layoffs.
The lessor in a wet lease is taking on enormous operational risk, though. They're responsible for crew scheduling, maintenance delays, everything that can go wrong with a flight.
which is why wet lease rates are significantly higher than dry lease rates, sometimes double or more, and why only specialized ACMI operators do it at scale. It's a completely different business model from the AerCaps of the world. AerCap is essentially a financial institution that happens to own aircraft. An ACMI operator is an airline that happens to lease its services out.
Which brings us to the strategic question Daniel raised. When does it actually make sense to buy versus lease? And the answer turns out to be surprisingly consistent across the industry.
It's basically a matrix of two things: balance sheet strength and route certainty. If you've got both, you buy. If you're missing either one, you lease. Delta owns about 70% of its fleet. Emirates is similar. These are carriers with strong credit ratings, decades of predictable route networks, and the cash flow to absorb the depreciation hit.
At the other end, you've got the startup that just got its air operator certificate last Tuesday. They're leasing everything. They don't have the cash, and they don't know if their routes will still exist in 3 years.
There's actually a scale threshold that shows up in the data. Below about 50 aircraft, direct purchases from Boeing or Airbus almost never make economic sense. The manufacturer discounts aren't deep enough, and the financing costs eat you alive. Between 50 and 100 is the transition zone. Above 100, if your routes are stable and your balance sheet is healthy, ownership starts to win.
Then you look at Ryanair and the whole framework gets weird. They're the ultimate low-cost carrier. The whole model is about stripping costs to the bone. And yet they own about 70% of their fleet. That seems backwards.
Ryanair is the exception that proves the rule. They order 737s in batches of 100 or more. Boeing gives them pricing that's basically wholesale. And because Ryanair flies one aircraft type to a limited set of airports on high-frequency routes, their utilization is insane. They can amortize ownership across more flight hours per day than almost anyone. The ownership math works for them because the operational model is so ruthlessly optimized.
The cargo operators must be the same story, right? Predictable routes, high utilization, own everything.
That's where it gets genuinely interesting, because the cargo world splits into two completely different philosophies. FedEx owns about 80% of its fleet. UPS is in the same range, 70-80% owned. And these aren't new planes. FedEx has hundreds of 757s and A300s that are 20 to 30 years old. They buy them used from passenger airlines, refurbish them, and fly them for decades.
Which only works if your routes are so predictable, you can plan aircraft utilization for the next 20 years.
The FedEx hub and spoke model, everything flows through Memphis at 2 in the morning. That network doesn't change much. They know exactly how many aircraft they'll need in 2035. So buying a 30-year-old 757 and converting it to cargo makes perfect sense. The purchase price is low, and they've got decades to squeeze value out of it.
Then there's Atlas Air, which is basically the opposite.
Atlas Air is fascinating. They operate almost entirely on ACMI wet leases for other companies. They fly for DHL, for Amazon Air, for the U.S. military. The aircraft have Atlas pilots and Atlas maintenance, but they're flying under someone else's brand and schedule. Atlas doesn't need to predict demand. Their customers do that. Atlas just supplies the operational capability.
It's the difference between being a manufacturer and being a contractor. FedEx is the factory. Atlas is the skilled tradesman you hire for a specific job.
That model makes Atlas incredibly flexible. When Amazon decided to build out Amazon Air, they didn't go buy a fleet of cargo planes. They contracted Atlas and ATSG to fly them. Amazon gets the capacity without the capital commitment, and Atlas gets long-term revenue without the demand risk.
That contractor model got stress tested in a way nobody expected during COVID. What happened to leasing when the whole industry shut down?
It was brutal, and then it was fascinating. In 2020 and 2021, airlines returned hundreds of leased aircraft early. Lessors suddenly had planes parked in the desert with no lease income and no easy way to place them. Lease rates dropped 15 to 25% almost overnight. Terms became dramatically more airline-friendly, shorter commitments, lower deposits, more flexible return conditions.
Because suddenly the lessors had no leverage. The planes were worth nothing sitting on the ground.
Now the pendulum has swung hard the other way. In 2024 and 2025, Boeing and Airbus have been struggling with delivery delays, the Boeing strike, the 737 MAX certification issues, supply chain problems everywhere. Airlines that ordered new planes can't get them, so they're extending existing leases instead of returning aircraft.
Which means the used aircraft market is on fire.
Lease rates for in-demand narrowbodies. A320neos, 737 MAX have risen sharply. Used A320ceos, the previous generation, saw lease rates jump about 20% year over year. Lessors who survived COVID are now in an extraordinarily strong position. They have the aircraft that airlines desperately need, and the manufacturers can't deliver new ones fast enough.
The industry lurched from, please take our planes, we're begging you to, you'll pay what we ask and you'll be grateful for the privilege, in about 3 years.
That's the aircraft leasing cycle in a nutshell. And it's why the lessors who manage residual value risk well can be incredibly profitable over the long term. They eat the downside in a crisis, but they capture enormous upside when capacity gets tight.
Which makes me wonder where this is all heading. If new aircraft keep getting more expensive, we're talking 120 million plus for a wide body now. And technology cycles are getting shorter with sustainability pressures.
That's exactly why the leasing share is probably going to keep climbing. Airlines can't afford to bet 120 million on an aircraft type that might be obsolete in 15 years if hydrogen or electric propulsion takes off. Lessors can spread that risk across hundreds of aircraft and dozens of carriers.
There's this blurring of the lines happening too. These power-by-the-hour maintenance agreements, where the manufacturer or lessor charges per flight hour for maintenance instead of a fixed contract. They're making dry leases feel increasingly like wet leases. The airline doesn't own the maintenance risk anymore.
It's a spectrum now, not a binary. You could have a dry lease with a power-by-the-hour engine agreement, plus a crew training contract, and suddenly you're most of the way to a wet lease without actually signing one. The industry is unbundling the aircraft from the services around it, and airlines are assembling exactly the package they need.
Which is probably the real answer to Daniel's question about why leasing dominates. It's not that airlines are bad at math. It's that flexibility and capital preservation matter more than the theoretical long-term savings of ownership, especially in an industry where the next disruption is always around the corner.
All of this has real implications for how you think about airlines. Whether you're an enthusiast tracking fleets, a business traveler trying to understand what you're actually buying when you book a ticket, or someone looking at the industry as an investment.
Start with the enthusiast angle. When you pull up an airline's fleet list on Planespotters or Chaviation, the percentage leased is one of the most revealing numbers on the page. An airline at 90% leased is telling you they're prioritizing flexibility and capital preservation. They can shrink or grow the fleet quickly. An airline at 30% leased is telling you they've got a long-term bet on their route network, and they're willing to sink billions into metal to prove it.
It's a risk indicator, too. High lease ratios mean high fixed monthly obligations that don't go away when demand drops. During COVID, the airlines with the highest lease exposure were the ones scrambling hardest. The owners could at least park their planes and stop flying, but the lease payments kept coming due.
For business travelers, there's a more practical takeaway. If you see a flight operated by a different carrier than the one you booked with, a code share where the operating carrier isn't who you paid, that might be a wet lease. And wet lease flights often have different service standards, different crew training, different cabin configurations, sometimes different catering.
The ticket will list the operating carrier in the fine print. It's worth checking. A Lufthansa flight operated by some ACMI provider you've never heard of is going to be a different experience than mainline Lufthansa. Not necessarily worse, but different.
Then there's the investor lens, which is where this gets underappreciated. Everyone knows you can buy airline stocks, but the lessors, AerCap, Air Lease Corporation, they're a completely different bet. You're not betting on whether Delta fills seats this quarter. You're betting on global aviation demand across dozens of carriers, and you're getting exposure to the asset values themselves.
Lessors are essentially a diversified play on aviation. When one airline struggles, the lessor repossesses the aircraft and places it somewhere else. The revenue base is spread across geographies and business models. It's not risk-free, COVID proved that, but it's a fundamentally different risk profile than owning a single airline stock.
The big picture here is that leasing didn't just change how airlines finance planes. It changed who can start an airline at all. The low-cost carrier revolution. IndiGo, AirAsia, Ryanair in its early days. That whole model depends on being able to acquire aircraft without billions in upfront capital. Leasing made aviation accessible to entrepreneurs in a way that ownership never could.
It's still doing that. The fastest growing aviation markets right now, Southeast Asia, Africa, parts of Latin America, they're being built almost entirely on leased aircraft. The lessors are effectively providing the infrastructure, and local airlines are providing the market knowledge and the operational execution. It's a service-based model that's replaced the old capital-intensive one. Where is all this heading? Here's the question I keep coming back to. As aircraft prices push past $120 million for a wide body, and technology cycles keep shortening, we're talking about hydrogen, electric, sustainable aviation fuel mandates. Does the pendulum ever swing all the way? A world where nobody owns planes, where every aircraft in the sky is on someone's lease book?
I don't think we get to 100%. There's always going to be a Delta or an Emirates, carriers with the balance sheet and the route certainty to make ownership pencil out. But 90%? That's not crazy.
The thing that could push us there is what's happening right now with the next generation of aircraft. Lessors are already placing orders for EVTOLs, electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, and hydrogen regional planes. Aircraft that don't exist yet for technologies where nobody knows what the residual value curve looks like.
Because nobody knows if a hydrogen fuel cell aircraft will still be worth anything in 15 years, or if it'll be the aviation equivalent of a Betamax player.
The lease structures for these things are going to have to be completely rethought. You can't do a standard 12-year dry lease on an aircraft where the propulsion technology might be obsolete in 8. You'd need shorter terms, technology refresh clauses, maybe something closer to how we lease computing infrastructure than how we lease aircraft.
Which brings us back to the image Daniel's prompt originally conjured. Next time you walk down a jet bridge and settle into your seat, look around. The airline whose name is stitched into the headrest, whose safety video is playing, whose livery is on the winglet outside your window. They're the operator. The actual owner is probably a financial firm in Dublin or Singapore that you've never heard of, collecting a monthly check and betting that this aluminum tube will still be valuable in 2038.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 11th century, the Songhai people of what is now Niger narrowly avoided a catastrophic dietary collapse when a regional council voted down a proposal to make roasted locusts the exclusive protein source during the dry season, preserving the millet and fish economy that sustained the empire for another 3 centuries.
I had no idea locust policy was that contentious.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, tell someone about it, or better yet, leave us a review wherever you listen. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com, and you can email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. For Herman Poppleberry, I'm Korn. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.